each of us has to build a new world order in which nations and peoples with different systems and different values can live together in peace.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations.
Now we can see a new world coming into view. A world in which there is the very real prospect of a new world order. It is a big idea. A new world order where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind. Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge.
There is a chance for the President of the United States to use this disaster to carry out what his father, a phrase his father used, I think, only once, and hasn't been used since, and that is a new world order.
There's a need for a new world order. In the next few years, a solution will emerge that people will look into that cauldron and decide that they have to learn their limits. But I think that at the end of this administration, with all its turmoil, and at the beginning of the next, we might actually witness the creation of a new order.
After 1989, President Bush kept said, and it's a phrase that I often use myself, that we needed a new world order.
It is a new mindset that the world now needs. It is a real global new deal that we need. An ecological and an economic new deal that we need. In the name of France, I call upon all states to join ranks in order to found the new world order of the 21st century.
I think the new world order is emerging, and with it the foundations of a new and progressive era of international cooperation.
We need a world of shared global rules, founded on shared global values.
When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
Oh, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Thank you for joining us from the land down under in Australia. Welcome to listeners from all over the world, from wherever you are listening. I really hope that you are well. Well, today is set to be a beauty here where I live. Change of seasons, beautiful days, beautiful sunny days, cool nights, and we are approaching into autumn where we live here. And yesterday was a beautiful day also, about 25 degrees, just nice bit of warmth in the air, but nice crisp evenings. I hope it's good for wherever you are, and I hope life is well for you. Each week on this program, we endeavour to focus on big changes that we see taking place all around the world. Changes that are facing our people. The people who love freedom, liberty. Our people are those people who treasure their national identity, their national culture, their family that they were born into. You see, we've all been born into a culture. We've been born into a nation which has a particular culture, an identity. Our identity is our family. Indeed, the family, the mother and the father, is a microcosm of the nation. And each week we document how social scientists, social architects, have for years been designing the destruction of the family. The destruction of the father being at the head of the family, and the beautiful woman being at his side. And together they form a partnership under God in the caring of their children, in the education of their children, in the training of their children for a future life. not only on this world, but in a world to come. And tyrannical governments, dictatorial regimes, indeed many of the architects behind these regimes have always known that the strength of a nation is within the nuclear family. Therefore, we see the greatest warfare being conducted today against the family unit. This spills out into the destruction of the community. Increase in violence, increase in crime, increase in disintegration, which flows into the state and into the nation. All these changes that we are witnessing and that we talk about here every week have been implemented without any vote, without any consent. Indeed, the consent is being manufactured. And the masses of individuals are being bought into a state of helplessness, knowing that many of these changes are just imposed upon the people. And that somehow if you are forced to vote for one of two sides in a contest once every 3 or 4 years, that this in itself constitutes democracy and you have no further need to resist. And that democracy, of course, is labelled as the great freedom, the great liberty institution of the West, whether it be under a republic, constitutional monarchy, or whatever the template or model of government may be. This, of course, is a lie, as we have questioned the narrative here often on what a democracy is. On all of the major issues, we have never been given a vote. All of the massive changes taking place to our culture, the forced multiculturalism agenda that is being implemented in Europe, United States, Canada, England, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, which is designed to create unrest, increase violence and crime, with the statistics of crime and unrest increasing exponentially with the increase of the multicultural agenda. Gang-related race wars in the cities, bombings, rape epidemics, are all symptoms of societal unrest. Mainstream commentators basically ignore the idea that multiculturalism is a cause for much of the violence, because multiculturalism is state-sponsored, state-sanctioned ideology. The Book of Daniel, chapter 2, talks about black and white at the feet and toes, where not only is it Rome being implemented throughout government structures, which is the first layer of interpretation of that prophecy, where the system of papal Rome, with a man at the head, which is the dictator, is the controller, is the figurehead of the global New World Order. Not only is one man at the head as a dictator, as a controller, but Rome is represented in Daniel 2 as the iron with force, with coercion, which is crushing the people into subservience. And the black and white layer of interpretation cannot be missed, with colour revolution groups overthrowing governments in the Ukraine, colour revolution groups pursuing cultural idealistic agendas, which are communistic agendas, in the West, gender wars, Black Lives Matter, race wars, the destruction of society in general, is all designed to bring about calamity, collapse, a surveillance police state, And all of these things are surely being implemented day by day. But in such a way that the people are hypnotized that this is just the way things are. That this is all happenstance. That there is no design to create a negroid Eurasian. And to cross-pollinate black and white, to interbreed. Which is what Daniel talks about with black and white. And he says that they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but shall not cleave one to another. There will not be peace and safety. The Bible says that when they say peace and safety, there cometh sudden destruction cometh upon them. So the massive changes that are taking place are conducted without we the people. Democracies are fast, friends. We are living in a corporate oligarchy. That's one descriptive. There's many descriptives. It is a new communism. It is communism by the back door. It is the mass integration of the third world into the first world. It is a mass transfer of economics from you, the people, working every day. Your taxes are increasing. Your debt on your country is increasing to pay for the mass integration of the third world into your culture. The transformation of your manufacturing base, which was once the staple of the middle class, in every Western nation, it is being taken to Bangladesh, to China, to India. And we are importing into this country people of low IQ, low educational standards into a new evolving high IT technocracy. Where robots are replacing humanity. And yet we're bringing humanity in that can't even press a button. That cannot cope with the developing IT world. The kingdom of Babylon in the Bible is referred to as a kingdom that is being ruled by merchants, corporations, and banks. And kings are subservient to the merchants because together they live deliciously with the great whore, the cultural religious orders of the day. And so the picture is that you have cultural, academic, religious organisations in league with banking and economic institutions, central banks, the Institute of think tanks, economic institutions, as well as central banking systems, all in league with kings, the governments. And you will find that every government has this meme, this narrative, that it must continue to push for economic growth, even though the worldwide economy is completely decreasing and slowly coming to a halt. So friends, we look at the timeline of prophecy and history with a biblical worldview from the eyes of we the people. So today, we are going to talk a little bit about earthquakes, race wars, the destruction of the family and the destruction of the European nations and indeed the European people. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a lawful notice. If you are likely to be offended by questions regarding commentary, analysis concerning race, gender, colour, sex, politics, economics, culture, religion, war, revisionist history, or Bible prophecy, or Bible teachings, you should leave now. The host of this broadcast accepts no responsibility, legal, lawful, warranties express or implied, hidden, open, or otherwise in any way, for any offence claimed. The listener, by proceeding from this point, accepts full responsibility in every way. You have been warned. Well, let's start with earthquakes, with five major earthquakes in 48 hours, as a seismologist warns catastrophic mega earthquakes are coming. So why is it that the crust of the Earth is shaking so violently all of a sudden, with five major earthquakes within 48 hours? One prominent seismologist has declared that catastrophic mega earthquakes could be on the way. Roger Bilhelm of the University of Colorado has made headlines all over the world by warning that current conditions might trigger at least four earthquakes greater than an 8.0 magnitude. If his projections are accurate, our planet could be on the precipice of a wave of natural disasters unlike anything that any of us has experienced before. And out of the Express, it reports that scientists say there have been an above average number of significant earthquakes across South Asia and the Pacific since the start of the year. The increased frequency has sparked fears of a repeat of the Nepal earthquake of 2015, when 8,000 people died, or even worse. So I'm going to talk about here what the Bible tells us about earthquakes into the future. Roger Bilhelm said the current conditions might trigger at least four earthquakes greater than 8.0 magnitude. Now, studying the earthquakes is very interesting because as we look at these magnitude graph, as in if a 6 magnitude or a 7 magnitude or an 8, it exponentially increases in velocity and strength each time. And it's a very interesting study to look at the way the different earthquakes transpire with the magnitude and the level of destruction around it. Now, we know there has been recently, if we look at a list of earthquakes that has taken place recently, there is the Ecuador earthquake, which was 19.2 kilometres deep under the earth. That was a 7.8 on the Richter scale, 7.8 magnitude earthquake. The one that hit Ozu in Japan was 5.7. Now, you'll notice that there's an incredible increase between, as I said before, for instance, 6 or 7, or 7 and 8. Now, the one in Ecuador, been many lives lost, and Japan, the 5.71, a lot of destruction there. Now, prior to that with Japan, there was actually, on the 15th, there was one at 5.7. On the 15th of April, there was one at 7.0 magnitude. On the 14th, the day before, there was one on 6.0 magnitude. In Japan, again, on the 14th, there was 6.2 magnitude. So there was actually four earthquakes in Japan within 2 days. And, of course, on the other end of the world, there was the one in Ecuador 1 day after that. So there has been, the question is, has there been an increase? And this is something that is an interesting study. And the more you look at it, the more incredible you realize there is a lot of earthquakes that take place all around the world all the time. But depending on their velocity, their magnitude, depends on the amount of destruction. In other words, there can be a small earthquake with a low magnitude of 4 or 5 out in the ocean that really doesn't affect anything. And the higher the magnitude, of course, the greater destruction. Now, while on earth, Yeshua, the Messiah, commonly known as Jesus Christ, this is what he said in Matthew 24:7. He said, nation would rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in diverse places. Now, of course, this is amongst a list of other things that are taking place. And therefore, we should expect earthquakes. This is not something that we should look at as, for instance, an abnormal sign of the times. Earthquakes will be like war. They will continue. There is some wars that are nominated and pointed out as specifically. But here, famines, pestilence and earthquakes in diverse places means in many places. And in places, earthquake watch around the world, different bodies that monitor the earthquakes constantly And there is always earthquakes all around the world in any 24-hour period. But the major ones are the things that we need to look for. Now, there's a couple of points here that I'd like to just mention about earthquakes into the future. In the book of Revelation chapter 13, chapter 11 and verse 13, it talks about an earthquake where it's speaking about Jerusalem. And I haven't got time to go into the whole context of the prophecy here, but it's talking about a time of trouble such as never was. And it is talking about Jerusalem that's nominated as the place where the Messiah was crucified. In verse 8, it's talking about, and the context of this is that Moses and Elijah come back to Jerusalem and they basically are there testifying to the rest of the world that the world is condemned, Jerusalem is dead, it's over, it's finished, this is right at the end. Now, nominating that Jerusalem is such a corrupt city, and this is where, in my own opinion, my own analysis of Bible prophecy, I differ from the Zionist narrative, which basically teaches that the location of Jerusalem on earth is this holy place, that all the world will go back there, that the Messiah will go there, and that we'll all go back and worship, and that's where it all will all happen. And of course, under that Zionist narrative, there is the idea that there will be war conducted against Jerusalem because it is the holy city, etc. Now, my narrative and my opinion and my analysis of Bible prophecy is that this city that was once a designated special place called a holy city has become corrupt. In Revelation 11, verse 8, it says that this city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt. Now, friends, Sodom and Egypt in the Bible are two of the worst descriptives you can give any city. Because it not only involves the ideology of those cities. Egypt was a city, and Pharaoh, the head of Egypt, is nominated in the Bible as the king of unbelief, of unbelieving nations, of nations that do not follow the true God, that have not accepted his son as the Messiah. And Sodom, of course, known for sexual perversity and homosexuality. And here, Jerusalem is nominated spiritually. It is called Sodom and Egypt. And notice that the next phrase gives no doubt as to what it's talking about and where it's talking about, where also our Lord was crucified. You see? And this is the city where Moses and Elijah come back to and testify to the whole world from this place. Now, there's going to be several really special things that take place around this time. But in chapter 11, verse 13, we read, "And that same hour was there a great earthquake." And this is when Moses and Elijah ascend to heaven. Their work of testifying to an unbelieving Egyptian, sexually perverse location, being Jerusalem, and from there out to the world, is over. Verse 13, "And the same hour there was a great earthquake, and a tenth part of the city fell. And in the earthquake were slain of men 7,000. And so there is going to be a great earthquake where a tenth part of the city of Jerusalem is going to be destroyed and 7,000 will be destroyed in that earthquake. Now, there is going to be no doubt about when this happens, about what is happening. For a start, Moses and Elijah are going to be there beforehand testifying that this city has rejected and that the people of this city and the people who have allegiance to that city worldwide have rejected Yeshua the Messiah and thereby rejected the Father in heaven, which is the true God, the creator of the universe. It says, these have power to shut heaven, that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, which is 3.5 years or 1260 days. And this is going to take place during a time of trouble such as never was. Now there's another earthquake, another large earthquake that is nominated in the scriptures in the book of Revelation 16. And once again, this is after the time of probation. No more salvation for humanity. It's over. Verse 17 said, the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air. And there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, it is done. That means it is finished. And it talks about the people that have got the mark of the beast. They're going to suffer from the vials that are poured out on the earth. Now, the Bible teaches us from past history what will happen in the future. So if we go back to Egypt, which is the template, meaning Egypt represents the whole earth, where God's people were being called out of the earth into another kingdom, and Egypt represents the unbelieving world, those who do not accept the gospel, those that do not have faith in God and in his son, and that don't walk in his kingdom, they are to be called out of the world. And this calling out is a continual process that goes through the timeline of history where God's people are called out of corruption. Noah and his family were called out of the world into the ark, which became their saviour at that time. Lot and his wife and family were called out of Sodom and Gomorrah. Moses and Aaron were used as voices to call God's people out of Egypt. Today, the true and faithful messengers of God are calling people out of Babylon. The corrupt, unbelieving Sodomite ministers are calling people into Babylon. They are transforming their religious institutions into Babylon. They have become the cage of every unclean, hateful bird. The true and faithful messengers are like John the Baptist standing out in the desert, isolated. Basically no support from the system at all. No, these tax exemptions, but no support. In fact, they're the target of King Herod. And as we look at the vials that are poured out on the people who receive the mark of the beast, those who choose not to come out of Babylon, we see the exact same thing happening in Egypt with the plagues falling upon Egypt prior to the Feast of the Passover, where the true and faithful slaughtered a lamb and ate that lamb the night before they left, when they left at midnight. And that lamb represented the death of the Messiah yet to come. Today we live in a period where the Messiah has died, there is no more shedding of blood, but we celebrate that same event at the Passover every year, as it says in Exodus, to remember it perpetually forever. So the event of calling God's people out of Egypt is intimately linked to the death of the Messiah and his power through his blood to redeem his people from Babylon into another kingdom. In Revelation 16:18, there were voices, thunders, and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is yet to come. We are going to see an increase in earthquakes. We are going to see major earthquakes. And we are going to see a major disruption to the systems in this world, economic, political, cultural, religious, and even the physical systems of this earth, like electricity grids, telephone systems, communication systems, As the technocracy develops and relies more and more on a technocratic infrastructure, when we see major events in nature, be it earthquakes, be it floods, be it storms, which disrupt those systems of governance, which are becoming more the proxy system of governance, in other words, the economic systems of the world. Imagine today. Can you imagine the chaos today if the electronic banking system went down for a week? How dependent people have become on a transaction every day. And this is what we will see. We will see incredible events of mass destruction taking place into the future. And so we need to arm ourselves by faith and prepare physically. And as I've said many times, the city is not going to be the place you want to be. The city, as outlined in the Bible, is the place where is the epicenter of all of the major problems that are about to come upon the earth. The cities are the center of race wars. The city is the center of the occult satanic systems of worship. The cities are where the majority of the unbelievers gather against the minority of the believers. God's people are going to be squashed and squeezed on this earth. And one indicator of that is this. The temple of Baal coming to New York will be followed by hundreds more all over the world. The reproductions of the 50-foot arch that stood at the temple of Baal in Palmyra, Syria, that will be erected in New York City and London next month will only be the first of many. So what's happening here? Well, this is the implementation of Baal worship right throughout the major cities throughout the world, indicating that the grace of God, that God himself has been ostracized from these cities. Now, last week, and in many broadcasts in the past, I've shared with you how the Bible teaches us that all men have been given a measure of grace. All men have been given a measure of faith. And that nations themselves have been given a measure of grace. And this measure of grace has been reflected in the Christian heritage of the nations. Many of the principles of the Western nations are built on Christian principles, grace from above. And as those nations and its kings and merchants reject those principles and replace those godly principles with satanic principles, the grace of God is being removed from the nations, and more emblems and more signs of who they serve are being erected. These symbols indicate the heart of the nation. There's plans to put hundreds of arches in more cities all around the globe. The organisation behind this is the Institute of Digital Archaeology, which is a joint venture between Harvard and the University of Oxford and Dubai's Museum of the Future. The initial arches from the Temple of Baal will be erected in New York and London as part of UNESCO's World Heritage Week. And they are attended as a gesture of defiance. But ultimately the plan is to share this cultural treasure with as many cities around the planet as possible. The life-size model of the original 2,000-year-old structure, known as the Arch of the Temple of Bel, will stand approximately 48 feet high and 23 feet wide. And once again, this is an indicator. And by the way, many of the emblems that we have and the images and the statues that we have in society already are emblems of occult, pagan systems of worship. And The Temple of Baal was known for its sexual promiscuity, from its homosexuality and sexual promiscuity in all its ways, including the sacrificing of children at the altar of Baal. And today it is not hard to see in society how children are being sacrificed at the Temple of Baal by the mass propaganda that is being implemented through the educational systems, where we have prominent academics joining with politicians to actually punish anyone that would dare to question the narrative. And children are taught not to resist the progressive agenda of the future, like Michael E. Kraft. Climate change deniers deserve punishment. Now, this is one of many, but we have covered in the past how many in the climate change fraud agenda have been advocating the punishment of those who don't believe, especially those who have a voice in the public place, in media, in governments. And we find, as I was speaking with Merrill Dury yesterday, we find a common thread here throughout the whole agenda of the Kingdom of Babylon. Whether it's multiculturalism, whether it's homosexuality, whether it's a transgender movement, whether it's the Islamization of the West, whether it's being critical of Jews and their role in the New World Order, whether it's any of the agendas under the progressive narrative, there is a similar thread. If you don't follow the vaccine agenda that the state and the major corporations are running, you get a hashtag label. And there is a call for you to be jailed, for you to be punished, for you to be fined, for your life to be disrupted, because you don't have a voice in this New World Order. On any of these issues, it's exactly the same thread. So it's very easy to group all of these things together, and you can see the same agenda is being conducted against anyone with any traditional view, with anyone with any biblical view. That's the heart of the traditional passage. That's the heart of the traditional narrative. Now, in this article, Michael Kraft says, denying the best scientific advice we have is neither smart nor safe. It could lead to greater societal harm. Now, when you see that passage, that statement, this is the communist narrative. In other words, one person should be killed to save greater societal harm. And he tries to draw an analogy between the tobacco giants, which basically said tobacco was no problem. Then years later they found out it is, and he's drawing a parallel here between tobacco and climate change. He went on to say that specifically, the lawsuit said that companies engaged in a conspiracy to launch a public relations campaign challenging scientific evidence that demonstrated the health risk of smoking at the time. And he said, here is a parallel to current controversies over climate change science. Well, of course, I don't agree with that, but this is his argument he's putting forward. Some members of the Congress say there is. Members of Congress have asked the Justice Department to pursue charges under RICO against major fossil fuel companies for knowingly deceiving the public and investors about the dangers of climate change when their own studies showed the reality of the threat. State attorneys said they would aggressively investigate whether fossil fuel companies misled the public and investors about the risks of climate change. And then the conclusion of the article is, what about extending the liability, they say, to think tanks and advocacy groups? That means, friends, silencing your voice in the public. If you disagree, you'll be penalised. Litigation, First step, financial penalty against those who don't vaccinate their children. Financial penalty against those who do not follow the climate fraud agenda. And this is exactly what they have been teaching the children, that those who don't agree with the green eco-fascist agenda should be punished.
Right, kids, just before you go, there's a brilliant idea in the air that I'd like to run by you. Now, it's called 10-10. The idea is everyone starts cutting their carbon emissions by 10%, thus keeping the planet safe for everyone, eventually. Now, this hasn't got to be a huge thing, but I would love it if you and your families would think about doing something.
What sort of thing, miss?
Well, like getting your dad to insulate the loft, or taking your next holiday by train instead of flying, or buying energy-saving light bulbs. We're thinking of using our car less. I'm going to cycle to school. That's fantastic, Jemima. Now, no pressure at all, but it'd be great to get a sense of how many of you might do this. Just a rough percentage. That's fantastic. And there's Nora. Philip and Tracy. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. Your own choice. Okay, class, thank you so much for today, and I will see you all tomorrow. Oh, just before you go, I just need to press this little button here. Now, everybody, please remember to read chapters 5 and 6 on volcanoes and glaciation. Except for Philip and Tracy, of course.
And there it is. Death and destruction for those who do not agree. Those who don't go along. Now, there's many parallels in the Bible. And I've long argued that this is the end game of the Kingdom of Babylon, and they will use whatever hashtag they want to go after those who are resisting the system. Now, the Bible talks about the implementation of the mark of the beast, and that this system would use coercion and force to implement this mark of the beast, and anyone who would not agree to that force or to that coercion would be killed. Now, here it is in black and white, with the 10-10 group implementing their climate change fraud agenda against the children. And with that particular group of advertising that was implemented some years ago now, before 2010, there was not only children getting blown up in the classroom, but there was adults being killed for their dissenting views. In the book of Revelation, chapter 13, verse 15, it talks about those that have the mark of the beast, that they wouldn't be able to buy or sell unless you had the mark of the beast. Well, in verse 15, it also says that this same power, this beast power, which is part of the kingdom of Babylon, that would cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast, that they should be killed. This is a death decree upon God's people. And once again, it was outlined in the book of Daniel. In the book of Daniel, chapter 3, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image out of gold, a replica of the image he saw in his dream that composed many different minerals and many different... It was made of gold, silver, brass, iron, and clay. The original dream, as Daniel interpreted it to him. And he said this was many nations, many kingdoms coming down to the end where a stone was cut out without hands, and that stone hit the feet of the iron and clay, the nations that were trying to amalgamate together under the UN New World Order agenda. And those nations received the vials and the plagues from heaven, which is really the withdrawal of grace. It is their own choice. When grace is withdrawn, friends, you die. That's the way it is. We only live. God causes the sun and the rain to rise on the just and the unjust. We only live by the grace of God every day. The sinner only lives because of God's grace in his life every day. Whether he recognizes or not, doesn't matter. God gives grace to all men. And as man rejects grace, he has more sin. He has more, the access of evil over his life takes more control. The same as a nation. The more a nation rejects God's principles, the more evil it becomes. The more the leaders, the kings of that nation, reject grace, replace the Christian principles that are in their constitutions with the trans movement and sodomite marriage, the open killing of babies through abortion laws. All of this adds to the darkness that a nation receives by nature. This is a natural law. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Christ Jesus, through Yeshua the Messiah. And so he would cause it, as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. King Nebuchadnezzar said, all who do not worship me, all who do not worship the image that I've set up, made of all gold, when the music sounds, unless you worship it, you die. And so history will be repeated. Now, for those who have hopes that a vote once every 3 or 4 years is going to change this system, vote all you want. The secret government will not change. The people we elect aren't the ones calling the shots, says Tufts University Michael Glennon. Now, the alternative media has been the canary in the coal mine for decades. Faithful ministers of God have been teaching for thousands of years that there would be a new cashless system implemented, as outlined by John. And that that economic sanction, that would give the ability for governments to create economic sanctions on the people. And we see a microcosm of this now in Australia, with parents who are dependent on a socialist system, and I don't agree with the socialist system, and as I was speaking with Merrill yesterday, I didn't go into depth in it, that wasn't the time, but a socialist system is bringing a people into subservience to the state for their everyday survival. Now, I understand that there are many of our listeners that are dependent upon government benefits. And it is, in my opinion, that we should do all we can to separate ourselves from that dependence. Now, for many of you, I know that's a very difficult situation. And I'm not judging you saying that you're evil or you're bad because of that. I'm just saying this is a system we've been bought into. We have all become dependent, especially parents, on, and pensioners, of course, and disabled, on a system where the family doesn't look after the family anymore. But the state has been developed to be the family. And that, as I mentioned the other week, if you took the amount of volume in the media that talks about government, on a percentage-wise, you would find that probably 75% or more of the topics on media, in mainstream media, are about government. This is a conditioning of the people over and over again about how the government is so important. And here we have Malcolm Turnbull with communist roots that stabbed Tony Abbott in the back, and now we have elections coming up not only in Australia but also in the United States this year. And in the United States, Donald Trump is saying he's going to get rid of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and many of the free trade deals. And in my opinion, he won't do this. And he won't be able to do it. Nevertheless, the people are putting hope in this one man that he will be able to make America great again. It's not going to happen, friends. Every now and then in mainstream media, articles come out which reveal that the canary in the coal mine, the alternative media, has been right all along. Because the alternative media is never given credit for it. They're always called conspiracy theorists at the time. Like, for instance, when we go back 10 years, alternative media was saying that the climate change agenda were going to put out this idea that those who don't agree with them should be killed. People were laughed at for saying that. Then the ads come out. Then it comes out a suggestion, anti-vaxxers should be jailed. Those who believe in government conspiracies, the Book of Revelation, should be jailed. These are considered the extreme right against the multicultural agenda, against the trans agenda. And there'll be not only economic sanctions, but physical sanctions on everyone who resists the Kingdom of Babylon. So you can vote all you want, the secret government won't change. And here Michael Glennon outlines exactly what alternative media has been saying for years. The voters who put Obama into office expect big changes, from the NSA's warrantless wiretapping to Guantanamo Bay to the Patriot Act. Candidate Obama was a defender of civil liberties and privacy, promising a dramatic different approach from his predecessor. 6 years into his administration, the Obama version of national security looks almost indistinguishable from the one he inherited. Guantanamo Bay remains open, and the NSA has, if anything, become more aggressive in monitoring Americans. Drone strikes have escalated. The same president won the Peace Prize. Is spending up to $1 trillion modernising and revitalising America's nuclear weapons. They're liars, friends. And the whole election campaign charade is designed to captivate your attention into this MCG matrix warfare, with both parties basically pursuing the exact same globalisation agenda. And by the way, if Donald Trump is saying he's going to dismantle the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the free trade agreements, and he did, I would say great. But the forces against him are too great. The merchants of the earth are not going to let one king dissent from their progressive agenda into building this new world order, which involves an economic technocracy, with all nations interconnected economically, all nations interconnected politically, otherwise as war, all nations interconnected culturally. Now, the growing technocracy is evident in the use of robots. And we see in China the new interactive robot goddess unveiled in East China. And here we have this goddess, Jia Jia, looks very much like a real woman. Compared to previous interactive robots, Jia Jia's eyeballs roll naturally and its speech is in sync with its lip movements, in addition to her human-like form. She can laugh or cry. Oh, sorry, she cannot laugh or cry, but these areas are being developed. So what they're doing, they're building robots, which I've mentioned to you before, replacing people in the workplace. And in Australia here, I know several distribution centres which are implementing robots. And these robots are replacing 4 and 5 people. No lunch breaks, no smoko breaks. Basically, they work around the clock. Now, this is an important part of the development of a technocracy, which has a eugenics element to it, as we've outlined, the destruction of people who don't agree, that cause unrest in society. Everyone who doesn't agree with the multicultural agenda is a racist, they're a problem. Get to that in a moment. Where there's a price tag put on racism, and therefore anyone that is costing the economy a lot of money, well, they should be removed. But following on with the robots, an Australian pizza company unveils world's first pizza delivery robot. And here it is, Domino's, in Sydney, has unveiled the world's first autonomous pizza delivery robot. Now, there has been stories of drones delivering pizzas to the front doors. They've got a few obstacles to get around in every way on that front, but that is the aim, that a drone would be able to deliver a pizza from several kilometres away to your doorstep. Well, here, this DRU prototype is the first step in the research and development, can travel at 20 kilometres an hour and is built to navigate in footpaths, trails and bike paths. Now, they're already trialling driverless trucks on the Euro motorways, and indeed even in Adelaide in Australia, they are trialling driverless cars and trucks. Now, the object of this operation, of course, is to replace humans. And so we won't have so many truck drivers on the road. The working class manufacturing base of each nation is being removed and replaced with this technocratic grid. Now, turning our attention to racism, we see that Victoria Health, in conjunction with Deakin University and the Australian Human Rights Commission, have developed a study. Now, what you'll find all the time, you'll find that in the news every day, if you're listening closely, you will hear a broadcast like this. A new study has revealed the cost of racism to Australia is $44.9 billion. The cost of racism to Australia is $44.9 billion. And so you will hear every day a new report like this. Now, these reports, which cost you, the taxpayer, millions of dollars to develop, are basically about putting a meme and a specific narrative into the public that media organisations can dwell upon, can refer to at any time as a leverage. For instance, down the track, a media commentator will say, well, we know that racial discrimination costs the Australian taxpayer around $45 billion a year. No, we don't know that. They can say we know only because this study has been put out saying this is real. It doesn't mean it is real. I mean, I could develop a study saying the little township I live in could be billions of dollars better off economically if we did this. I mean, any study can be developed about anything. The bloke that put this together was Dr. Elias, saying that racial discrimination costs society in both a microeconomic sense, such as indirect cost related to the labour market, and a macroeconomic sense, such as intangibles related to negative physical and mental health. Now, he goes on to say that racial discrimination causes depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and psychological disorders. Now, I could turn this around and develop a study how the government is costing Australians billions of dollars a year because of the depression that government causes, because of the anxiety that government causes, and the post-traumatic stress disorder that government causes by forced taxation, by the initiation of force and violence over the people, and the psychological disorders that confusion in government cause the people. You could turn this study around very easily, but the purpose of this study is, quote, in countries like Australia where subtle interpersonal racism exists, along with some forms of institutional discrimination, anti-discrimination interventions, there's the key, interventions, require relatively moderate spending. And so in the millions of dollars that was needed to develop this study, what is the end game here? The end game is to tell you, the people that love their national culture, that love their white European base and their family, that you are evil and that you are going to hear more, there's going to be more programs, there is going to be billions of dollars thrown at this research to develop more programs to say that you are evil. My daughter pointed out an ad campaign this week. It's run on mainstream television. And it's actually run on YouTube as well. And I saw it because we were watching YouTube together about a certain subject, and out come this ad where there's two children and the little girl saying, I want to be equal. And the boy's saying, I will develop a future where I will make society equal for you. The downpressed woman. Now, friends, this is propaganda in the modern era being promoted through children on the new trans agenda of the future, whether it's trans cultural, whether it's transsexual, whether it's trans religious, Whether it's trans-political, whether it's trans-economic or trans-cultural, it is the trans-New World Order of the future. And it is, children are being used, and studies like this are being used, to actually psychologically control and hypnotize the people into following everything that the state says. And that they will find the way to peace and safety. Not the God of heaven. Not the man that came here and shed his blood and died to save you from your sins. That's not the answer of the kingdom of Babylon. The kingdom of Babylon is a socially progressive, trans, new world order of the future. Without resistance. And any resistance will be punished. Now talk about counting the cost of racism. If we just have a look at the Philippines president saying to stay out of Campaign Australia. Now this presidential candidate over there, a leading candidate for the Philippines presidency, has told Australia to stay out of the campaign after criticism of his outburst on the rape and killing of an Australian missionary. Rodrigo Duterte was condemned for joking that he should have been first in line to rape the missionary before her 1989 murder. Mr. Duterte was the mayor of Davao at the time of a prison riot in which a 36-year-old woman was visiting the jail, was taken hostage, raped and killed, and four other hostages were killed in the incident. A YouTube video appeared over the weekend showing Mr. Duterte speaking at a recent rally, telling supporters that inmates had lined up to rape her and it was a waste because as mayor he should have been first. But that can't be because all cultures are equal, right? I mean, under the multicultural agenda, there's nothing wrong here. Because the mindset in the Philippines is the same as the mindset in Australia. All cultures are equal under the trans agenda. And another one who's found out that that's not the case is, of course, the 60 Minutes team. Reporter Tara Brown and a crew that have been jailed over there for getting involved with an Australian mother who have paid, allegedly, a group to kidnap her children. Now, the latest in this, of course, is that they have arrived at a negotiated settlement. However, the charges against Tara Brown and the 60 Minutes crew remain, and apparently they've been released, even though they've still got charges of kidnapping and criminal conspiracy, they've been released pending a negotiated settlement. Now, it seems as though the father of the children is well connected over there and is well connected to the judiciary and the political class, and that it seems as though Mr. Ellermine dropping the charges was basically a part of a deal that had been reached ahead of the court appearance. So it looks like Channel 9 has to open the checkbook to pay off this Mr. Ellermine. Of course, this will never be admitted. It will never be brought to light what happened here. But you will find, I think, that if this settlement is paid by a certain time, the charges will go away. And so a very interesting story in... And you know, one thing that I often think about with this, how the woman always has a sympathy in the West regarding child custody. And there's many different stories that many of you are aware of this fact. And that men are always looked at as evil and they have to plead for custody and indeed have any access to their children. Well, here the reverse has happened where, of course, apparently the husband took the children from Australia to Lebanon. I'm not sure about that, about the facts of all that case, but nevertheless, the woman goes over there, pays a crew to kidnap them. Channel 9 is going to have this blockbuster hit on 60 Minutes. It all goes wrong. They get caught. But imagine if he had have come here and done that. Imagine if the father had have kidnapped the children in Australia and got caught, do you think there would have been a deal done? Do you think the payment could have been made and the charges just miraculously dropped? I doubt it. So very interesting. Channel 9 has got some real issues here regarding their crew in Lebanon. And the multicultural agenda continues. Now, looking at another issue which is connected with this, the Andrews government grooming children. Now, the Australian has reported that the sexualisation of children is not a method of domestic violence prevention. At worst, it is an insidious form of abuse often used by pedophiles to groom their victims. Yet Daniel Andrews' government has funded another program in schools that encourages adults to sexualise children and expose them to sexually explicit materials. Now, recently we've been reporting at length on the Safe Schools program and how that program is designed to introduce the children to the trans agenda and to acclimatise them to it, to psychologically have them dumbed down to the dangers of the trans agenda and to encourage them to explore the idea that they're not really boys, they're not really girls, that they can just change it by surgery, despite paediatrician groups coming out and saying, this is wrong. We should not be dealing with our children like this. Now, Daniel Andrews, and Victoria, by the way, is the most advanced socialist, fascist, communist government in Australia, as far as the states go. It is well advanced. And you look at the way its voting patterns are, it's always majority Labor, every way. Natasha De Bider in Australian, reported that the Andrews government has dedicated $21.8 million to extending Building Respectful Relationships program. Its objectives are to educate students about gender, violence, and respectful relationships as part of state and federal initiatives to prevent violence against women. And see, what happens is that all of these agendas come in under a new tag. In other words, they come in under preventing violence against women. You'll notice that Turnbull threw, I think, another $1 billion to violence against women just recently, another $1 billion to the Green Agenda. These are all the agendas of the Kingdom of Babylon, which have really another objective, apart from what's stated. In this case, it's about the sexualising of children. Despite a stated claim to work against premature sexualisation, BRR, and that's Building Respectful Relationships Program, encourages explicit discussion of sexuality, including writing personal advertisements and anal sex. Lessons also cover transgenderism and deconstructing gender. Yeah, these people, these poor people that are so psychologically twisted and queer, have this idea that a boy isn't a boy and that a girl isn't a girl. Students are coached to use the gender-neutral term, partner, instead of boyfriend-girlfriend, and to be inclusive of gay and lesbian partnerships. It is unconscionable that a government would knowingly promote lessons that give effect to disassociative response that is common to victims of child sex abuse. In a lesson supposed to provide different perspectives on sexual intimacy, children are used in a role-playing exercise so psychologically harmful they may need to de-role afterwards. In one of the lessons, teachers are warned that as a result of program content, students may have slipped into a state of distress or disassociation. Teachers are instructed to de-role children by asking them to state their names, etc., etc. The fashionable fronts of sexual diversity and social inclusion are no excuse for abuse. Ladies and gentlemen, This is child abuse. It is bringing children into a state of confusion and distress. The word Babylon means confusion. It is, as the social engineers said, Russell and others in the past, we will teach children to say and to believe that snow is black, that you're born a boy but you're really a girl. That's what this is. It is a psychological program to confuse children, to feminize the men, to masculinize the women, through the food, through the sprays in the air, through the poisoning of water, through the sexualization of media, and the input that the children put into their lives in every aspect. This is the agenda of the Kingdom of Babylon. And many different people doing good work on this, including Salt Shakers. And for those Christians out there who aren't aware of this, I will leave a link. Go to the Salt Shakers website. You can sign up for their newsletter, a very good newsletter, which basically puts down many different articles are taking place in Australia on many different issues. And in here, they have an article here from Miranda Devine, the Daily Telegraph, who is talking about Alan Joyce, the charming Irish-born Qantas boss, doing a pretty good impersonation of an authoritarian dictator with his demands that corporate Australia promote same-sex marriage or else. And if the public isn't happy about this militant politicisation of Australian businesses, too bad. Quote, if you're unhappy with a company that's involved with the campaign, you won't be able to bank and you won't be able to fly anywhere, he said. He told the gay and lesbian newspaper, The Star Observer. So much for diversity. And this is the thing, friends, the diversity hashtag, the equality hashtag is a lie. It is about taking away the diversity of a man and woman and turning society into a trans drone. And if you resist, you're a bigot, you're a homophobe, you're anti-Semitic, you're anti-Islamic, all of the hashtags. You know, I was thinking about the other day about these hashtags. I was thinking, well, I'll take the lot. I think all these hashtags apply to me. And so who cares? I mean, once someone gives you a hashtag, they've lost the argument. If debating a particular topic is as easy as one hashtag word, and that's it, that's your point of the argument, you've got nothing. You've lost. Your argument's gone. I prefer to think. I prefer to think intellectually about all the different points of every argument and argue the case from a biblical worldview, from the worldview of the natural family, from the worldview of the natural national identity of my culture, of my people. Inclusiveness and tolerance is compulsory in this brave new world of marriage equality. You know, we've looked at books like 1984 by George Orwell, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. We've brought you the quotes talking about how Huxley said that they were going to use anything they could, including injections. And that Bertrand Russell said we'll use injections, vaccines and other things to dumb down the population. We'll use poisons in the water like fluoride. We'll use a psychological hypnotic program to completely deceive the people. And now we have mainstream media like Miranda Devine talking about this Brave New World. It's here, friends. 1984 and Brave New World were inspired by the enemy to reveal what was coming under the Kingdom of Babylon. And you can't argue it. It's here. What's in those books and what was written decades ago is here today. This brave new world of marriage equality. That's unless you believe in traditional marriage. You know, marriage between a man and a woman. That kind of has always existed for thousands of years. Amanda writes, Miranda writes, then you're a bigot, a homophobe, a non-human who deserves nothing but the cruelest excommunication. Read in there what the Bible says. No buying and selling, death penalty. The cruelest excommunication. So whether it's Qantas or Virgin you want to fly with, whether it's Westpac or the Commonwealth Bank, or Bankwest or St George or ANZ, Telstra or Optus, no dissent is allowed. Everyone has to be seen marching merrily in lockstep towards the mandated redefinition of our foundational social structure, or else. Just look what happened to Telstra this week. Monstered by the tolerance police into a humiliating backflip on its minor concession to the Catholic Church that it would tone down its campaign promoting same-sex sex. Sorry, promoting same-sex marriage out of consideration for one of its biggest customers. And it goes on to say how Telstra and all the major corporations are being strong-armed by this militant equality agenda whose aim is to indoctrinate the children and to completely psychologically traumatise and control them as a result. And so we have gay activists. Of course, our goal is to indoctrinate children into LGBTQ agenda. I'm here to tell you, he said, all the time I said I wasn't indoctrinating anyone with my beliefs about gay and lesbian and bi and trans and queer people. That was a lie, writes longtime Canadian gay activist Bergman, a woman who identifies as a transgender man. In a piece appearing on Huffington Post a week ago, tellingly titled, I've Come to Indoctrinate Your Children into My LGBTQ Agenda and I'm Not a Bit Sorry. There it is. Out in plain view. In plain view, exactly what's taking place. The radicalisation, indoctrination of the children. And another article from Mass Resistance. Behind the scenes in the gay clubs in schools. Radical and angry adult activists attacking parents. A report from Tennessee. The universal refrain from the homosexual movement about criticism of the gay clubs in the schools is that it's all organised and run by students, not by adults. And it's simply a support group for gay students who are bullied in school and may even feel suicidal. And so this is the meme, that they are in love and that there's this tolerance agenda, equality, diversity, but the truth is actually the opposite. The LGBTIQU agenda is really a militant political, ideological idea pushing the sodomite, homosexual, transgender movement on the children and indeed forcing it onto the children. And we see Facebook is, of course, right behind this agenda. A report where it censors a traditional marriage defender. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, every week you could just focus on Facebook alone. If this was the only thing that you wanted to look at, you could look at Facebook censoring people around the world that are endeavouring to hold to any sort of tradition. Zuckerberg is all for the whole New World Order agenda. Everything. He's behind it. As we know in the past, Merkel has said to him, we have to do something about the voices that are speaking up against this forced multiculturalism of Europe. Zuckerberg agreed. And here's another example. Facebook has been accused of censoring views that differ from its own social agenda after it deleted a post by a Sydney man who suggested that same-sex marriage advocates should accept some of the blame for making gay people feel marginalised. John Dickinson, who runs the Centre for Public Christianity, posted the opinion to his 10,000 friends and followers on Saturday morning. calling for a more respectful conversation on the divisive issue. By that night, Facebook had removed the post because it did not adhere to the social media giant's community standards. There it is. It was later posted, reappeared around 8:30 that night, after former Human Rights Commissioner Tim Wilson approached the company. And so here we see Facebook, of course, very much at the forefront of the whole labour agenda. Now, here is a bloke called Timmermans talking about Europe must accept diversity or face war.
In some parts of Europe, seen as a threat. Diversity comes with challenges. But diversity is humanity's destiny. There is not going to be, even in the remotest places of this planet, a nation that will not see diversity in its future. That's where humanity is heading. And those politicians trying to sell to their electorates a society that is exclusively composed of people from one culture are trying to portray a future based on a past that never existed. Therefore, that future will never be. Europe will be diverse. Like all other parts of the world, we'd be diverse. The only question is, how do we deal with that diversity? And my answer to that is by ensuring that our values determine how we deal with diversity and not giving up our values to refuse
immigration coming in, yeah. Okay, stay together. Get your cameras out. JMO, get your cameras out.
And so there he is. Europe must accept diversity or face war. Frans Timmermans, a Dutch diplomat. And so this is what they're saying now. From now on, it's all out in the open. The forced multicultural agenda is here. There is no dissent. Now, it's very interesting that a former chief of Britain's Equalities and Human Rights Commission, Trevor Phillips, has admitted that the path that Britain has been on for years is a catastrophic failure, that Muslims will not associate and become loyal Britons. He wrote, "For a long time, I too thought that Europe's Muslims would become like previous waves of migrants, gradually abandoning their ancestral ways, wearing their religious and cultural baggage lightly, and gradually blending into Britain's diverse identity landscape. I should have known better." Instead, he wrote, "Muslims are creating nations within nations in the West. Muslims are the only immigrant group that comes to Western countries with a ready-made model of society and government, Sharia, which they believe to be superior to what we have here, and they work to institute it. The admission of defeat is all the more remarkable coming from Phillips, who was the one who popularized the term, in my words, the hashtag, Islamophobia in Britain. This very word, Islamophobia, was pushed by Phillips as a new hashtag to demonise those who were against the Islamisation of their society. Abdul Rahman Muhammad, a member of this 3T group, who has renounced the group in disgust. He was an eyewitness to the development of the word Islamophobia. And he said this, "This loathsome term," he wrote, "is nothing more than, I thought, terminating cliche conceived in the bowels of Muslim think tanks for the purpose of beating down critics. The term Islamophobia was designed specifically for the Western mindset of liberal white guilt. In reality, Islamophobia is nothing more than the term that Islamic supremacists use to to enforce Islamic blasphemy laws in the West. In Islamic law, to defame or insult Muhammad or Islam is blasphemy. And in many Muslim countries, it is punishable by death. In the Western world, Islamophobia is being used in racial discrimination laws to implement Sharia. Now, it doesn't matter where you look, and I've got hundreds of articles here of all around the world. Sweden at breaking point. Migrant crisis is pushing the Scandinavian country to the edge. Down here in Australia, violent brawl at Halal Food Festival in Ascot Vale. Another one. Anti-Muslim banner. AFL disappointed, names are not taken. What does all this mean? These are all symptoms. These are all indicators of the cultural tension that is being developed through forced multiculturalism. Let's go to a clip now from Black Pigeon Speaks regarding creeping Sharia, the Islamization of the world.
ونبشرهم بأننا على موعد أن نفتح روما كما فتحت القسطنطينية وكما ستفتح ثانية إننا على موعد أن نحكم العالم كما قال الحبيب المصطفى صلى الله عليه وسلم.
A demographic tidal wave is washing over the West, and the vast majority of people coming to demographically replace indigenous Western people are of the Islamic faith. Already, the adherents of this ideology have begun to displace native populations within cities, and projections hold that the Muslim population will continue to grow exponentially. But unlike most civilizations that were Islamized, it will not be by the sword alone, but via the Muslim womb and the pathological altruism of the West, who through taxation and redistribution are funding their own colonization. With an exploding Muslim population, jihadist terror attacks are becoming ever more common, and terrorists that murder in the name of Islam are very clear about their motivation as well as their goals. They unleash violence upon disbelievers to fulfill violent jihad and wish wholeheartedly to subjugate the world for Islam, as is instructed by Allah in the Quran. And they're very careful to explain this. But it would seem those in controlled media and the political class do not want to listen to the jihadists themselves, but instead provide their own explanations for Islamic terrorism. Leftists want you to believe it's poverty, rightists want you to believe they hate our freedoms, Sam Harris wants you to believe that Islam is inherently violent, Ben Affleck wants you to believe that any questioning of Islam is racist, Muslims want you to believe it's only a tiny and unimportant minority. Thus, the comical script for the aftermath of whenever the next Islamic terror attack comes seems already to have been written and mostly agreed upon. Step 1. Tearful, sad cartoons need to be published. Step 2. Facebook flag filters for whichever country is bombed. Step 3. Crying on TV of citizens, newscasters, politicians, whoever. Step 4, lighting up some buildings as well as a candlelight vigil. Step 5, the media will incessantly push how Muslims are the real victims, as their faith has been hijacked by those that don't understand the real Islam and are living in fear of a backlash that never seems to materialize. Step 6, wait for the next jihadist attack. Wash, rinse, repeat. The West has been lying to itself for so long that it's come to believe its own lies. It was Samuel P. Huntington who very accurately described Islam and its relations with others in his book, The Clash of Civilizations. In Eurasia, the great historic fault lines between civilizations are once more aflame. This is particularly true along the borders of the crescent-shaped Islamic bloc of nations, from the bulge of Africa to Central Asia. Violence also occurs between Muslims on the one hand and Orthodox Serbs in the Balkans, Jews in Israel, Hindus in India, Buddhists in Burma, and Catholics in the Philippines. Islam has bloody borders. Wherever Islam comes into contact with other civilizations or other religious communities, it's rarely peaceful. Islam is not a religion like other religions. In its fullest form, it is a complete and total system of life. Islam has religious, legal, political, economic, social, and military components. In the book Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam, The Historical Roots and Contemporary Threat, written by Dr. Peter Hammond, and it explores the topic of the impact that an increasing Muslim population has on a society. As long as a Muslim population remains under 2% in any given country, they will, for the most part, be regarded as a peace-loving minority and not as a threat to other citizens. This is the case in these countries. At 2 to 5%, they begin to proselytize from other ethnic minorities and disaffected groups, often with major recruiting from jails and among street gangs. This is happening in these countries. From 5% on, they exercise an inordinate influence in proportion to their percentage of the population. For example, they'll push for the introduction of halal food, thereby securing food preparation jobs for Muslims. They'll increase pressure on supermarket chains to feature halal on the shelves, along with threats for failure to comply. This is occurring in these countries. When Muslims approach 10% of the population, they tend to increase lawlessness as a means of complaint about their conditions. In Paris, we are already seeing regular mass car burnings. Any non-Muslim actions that offend Islam result in uprisings and threats, such as the Charlie Hebdo massacre, also in Paris. Such tensions are seen daily, particularly in Muslim sections in these countries. After reaching 20%, nations can expect hair-trigger rioting, jihad militia formations, sporadic killings, and the burnings of Christian churches and Jewish synagogues, such as in Ethiopia. At 40%, nations experience widespread massacres, chronic terror attacks, and ongoing militia warfare, such as in these countries. From 60%, nations experience unfettered persecution of non-believers of all other religions, including non-conforming Muslims, sporadic ethnic cleansing, use of Sharia law as a weapon, and the jizya, a tax placed on infidels, as in these countries. After 80%, expect daily intimidation and violent jihad, some state-run ethnic cleansing, and even some genocide, as these nations drive out infidels and move toward 100% Muslim. Such has been experienced and in some ways is ongoing in these countries. 100% will usher in the Islamic House of Peace. Here, there's supposed to be peace because everybody is Muslim. The madrasas are the only schools and the Quran is the only word, such as in these countries. The first rebuttal to these observable behaviors is that to criticize the ideology of Islam is to have a problem with Muslims as people, and is usually framed by tying the criticism to race. It's much easier to do this than to accept the very uncomfortable fact that Islam is very different from other religious traditions. Another common tactic is to claim that, well, all religions are the same. In the U.S., religious fanatics have killed people at abortion clinics. Well, yes, some of the killers were religious, there's no doubt about that, but consider the scope of the problem. There have been 6 deadly attacks over a 43-year period since the legalization of abortion in the U.S., with 10 people having been killed, 3 of those just last year. More people were killed in one bomb set off at the Brussels airport in March 2016, let alone the thousands of other jihadist attacks that have happened around the globe since 9/11. The next criticism to pointing out these behaviors by Islamic extremists would be to say, well, yes, well, maybe most terrorists are Muslim, but not all Muslims are terrorists. Yes, of course. Many nominal Muslims are themselves ignorant of the most violent aspects of Islam and want nothing more than to live a peaceful life in the West. As individuals, Muslims are free to dismiss the parts of Islam they find distasteful via the guise of context. But the same question can be easily turned around. If Islam is a religion of peace, then why is it the only one that consistently produces religiously motivated terrorist attacks? Why are there literally thousands of Muslims that are ready to strap a suicide bomb to their body and walk into crowds of innocent people, scream Allahu Akbar, God is greater, and murder indiscriminately? Muslims and their apologists can believe whatever they want about Islam, but this does not change what Islam, a documented ideology, has to say about itself. Moreover, there are very troubling signs coming out of the already massive established Muslim communities in the West. For example, 20% of British Muslims sympathize with 7/7 bombers, 16% of Muslims in Belgium state terrorism is acceptable, 26% of younger Muslims in America, 35% in Britain, 42% in France, 22% in Germany, and 29% of young Muslims in Spain believe suicide bombings are justified. And 45% of British Muslims agree that clerics preaching violence against the West represent mainstream Islam. Muslim Americans who identify more strongly with their religion are 3 times more likely to feel that suicide bombings are justified. 19% of Muslim Americans say that violence is justified in order to make Sharia the law in the United States. Following the November 2015 attacks in Paris, 1 in 4 young Muslims in Britain say they sympathize with those who fight for ISIS. And an astonishing 2/3 of British Muslims would not turn a terrorist into police. And it goes on and on and on and on. Yes, of course, for most of the statistics cited, the majority of Muslims do not agree with an extremist interpretation of Islam. However, sizable minorities do, and they make up millions of people, and in most countries, the second and third generation of Muslims are more radicalized than their parents. And with the flow of Muslims ramping up into the West by the millions, social, criminal, and cultural problems are set to explode, literally and figuratively. And for the imposition of Sharia, no motion, debate, or approval by a bicameral parliament is necessary. Sharia has already arrived.
Children across Britain are being exploited for sex by organized gangs in growing numbers.
Muslim patrols are again active in London, with vigilantes trying to impose Islamic ideals on the local population.
And so while do you feel that you are British?
I identify myself as a Muslim. If I was born in a stable, you know, I'm not going to be a horse.
We are Muslim Patrol. We are in North London. We are in South London, East London, and West London. We command good, and we forbid evil. Islam is here in London. Mr. David Cameron, Mr. Police Officer, whether you like it or not.
A woman in a short skirt is abused.
Vigilante.
They're not dressed like that in Muslim area.
I'm so appalled.
We don't care if you're appalled at all.
Muslim patrol.
Muslim area. It's Great Britain.
Yes, we don't care. It's not so Great Britain.
You need to get out of here.
A man the patrol thinks is gay is insulted.
Get out of here quicker then. You're dirty, mate. You're a gay, mate. Get out of here, mate.
Night of what it calls the appalling abuse of at least 1,400 children over a period of 16 years, from 1997 to 2013. It details children being raped, trafficked, beaten, and sometimes doused in petrol. The inquiry says almost all the perpetrators were of Pakistani heritage.
رغم عنوفكم يا أيها الألمان يا أيها الأمريكان يا أيها الفرنسيون يا أيها الطليان.
In the wake of the 2015 Paris attacks, the Molenbeek municipality in Brussels was described as a Muslim no-go area, where gang violence and Islamic radicalization has fed off the neighborhood's festering resentment of authority. In 2015, Belgium's Home Affairs Minister said that the government did not have control of the situation in Molenbeek, and that terrorist links to the district were a gigantic problem. The neighborhood has found notoriety as a hotbed of violent jihadist ideology. In Sweden, the rape capital of Europe, the small town of Östersund, I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, has called off Earth Hour this year. Earth Hour, which started in 2007 as a lights-off event to raise awareness about climate change. But turning off the lights in this tiny town is too dangerous for Swedish women. Why is that? Well, authorities have lost control of the city, and women are being sexually assaulted in alarming numbers. While police won't comment on the perpetrators, as is the case in most Western countries, all of the victims claim their rapists were not native Swedes. Victims ranged from adults to young girls, and attackers remain on the loose. Women all over formerly peaceful Sweden are now being told to walk in groups or with a chaperone and not to walk alone for fear of gang rape. In Birmingham, Sharia courts operate in the shadow of British law, offering rough justice for Muslim women. But ironically, there are fears that if Sharia courts were to be closed down, they would just appear underground, making it harder for them to be regulated. It's said that there are some 85 such courts in Britain, but the actual number is unknown. A central German regional railway is launching a special women and children-only area for their trains on their Leipzig and Chemnitz route. The compartment will also be next to the onboard office of the train guard or ticket inspector, and the company said the local proximity to the customer service representative was chosen deliberately. This is again in response to the massive surge in sexual assaults on women and children attributed to the Islamic migrants pouring into the country. Also in Germany, schools have banned revealing blouses, shorts, and skirts in the name of modesty to help prevent migrants from sexually assaulting school children. And even in the United States of America, the leading cable news channel CNN, like most other controlled media outlets, has been forced through fear of violence to uphold Sharia law and its prohibition on any likeness of Muhammad being publicly displayed. Just after the Charlie Hebdo massacre in again Paris, CNN blurred images of the magazine that had the cartoon depictions of Muhammad. But CNN was not alone, as virtually all controlled media outlets did exactly the same thing, following the injunctions of Sharia and censored the cartoons. And you can find example after example after example of creeping Sharia in the West, from non-halal food bans to Islamic street patrols, honor killings, gender-segregated swimming pools, polygamy, and more. Don't kid yourself. Sharia has already arrived. People tend to forget that Egypt, Syria, Turkey, most of the Middle East, in fact, was at one time Christian. The same goes for Kosovo. There is no way around this. All demographic projections lead to the same conclusions. If there is no dramatic shift in policy, then there will be an Islamic future for Western Europe. Islam is not coming to integrate any more than European settlers that arrived in North America intended on assimilating to Native Americans' customs and way of life. Islam is not coming to be part of any multicultural tapestry of distinct but equal groups living side by side in peace and tolerance. Islam is not coming to uphold or carry on the cultural traditions of Western civilization. Islam is coming, and it is already in the process of doing what it has done to every society that it has ever come into contact with. Spread Islam by whatever means, whether through the suicide bomb or the womb. Nobody is saying there's any logic to any of this, but it is happening, and the elected political class of almost every Western country is only accelerating the process. Just as the cultures of antiquity were snuffed out by Islam, so too will the West if it does not realize that the respite in Islam's desire to conquer Rome was a tactical truce, not the end of the war.
So there he is, Black Pigeon Speaks, and I'll leave the link there to that original video. Now, this is speaking about Islam. We've been speaking about Islam and indeed the Islamification of the West. And there is another cultural group that cannot be ignored, which is ignored, and that is the Jewish cultural group. Now, over the years, we have been documenting that much of the cultural warfare that we are in at the moment has originated out of a group of people known as the Frankfurt School. And a very good article here, which I will leave for your consideration, is Deconstructing the Jewishness of the Frankfurt School. Now, there's been much work done on this from many different people. This particular one, most accounts of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, the grouping of social and political thinkers briefly based at the Frankfurt School, Institute for Social Research, until Hitler's arrival to power forced them into exile. Note that they were predominantly German Jews. Now, there's been much work done on this. Of course, Karl Marx has been the greatest influence on many of these philosophers, sociologists, and psychoanalysts. Among these, some of them were Max Horkheimer, Theodor Adorno, Herbert Marcuse, and many of these were the thinkers, the authors, the philosophers, sociologists that promoted the Frankfurt School and the agenda of Karl Marx, and indeed what we understand to be cultural Marxism today. Now, this is evident more and more that this agenda has been architecturally designed and promoted through Jewish interests over the last 100 years especially. And we have an article here which shows an evidence of this in the Jerusalem Post, where it states that Stanford student leader saying it is not anti-Semitic to claim Jews control the media and economy. Now, often these stories are actually documented to reveal Jewish power or to reveal the control that Jews have over the public narrative. In other words, in the public narrative today, and we've always talked about the many different layers to the New World Order, how Islam is being utilised today to bring about this cultural amalgamation warfare on the ground. And to those who don't understand the different layers of the New World Order, they just look at Islam as the problem. But the architects, those who are promoting it, are never looked at. And of course, this is because the focused history of the Jewish people over the last 100 years is that they are the victims, and that therefore, as the victim group, they're never responsible for any of the things that they advocate. And most notably, we've brought to you many reports of rabbis and Jewish groups all supporting the total multiculturalism of the West and Europe, and really promoting white guilt and promoting the destruction of white European people. And of course, this goes hand in hand with the Holocaust story, because they see Hitler and National Socialism as the enemy of Jewish interests, even though, as we've documented in the past, Israel basically doesn't accept refugees, but they're telling all the rest of the world to do, and many of the different hypocritical positions that we've looked at in that. Well, this student who advocated, a member of Stanford's University Student Senate, argued that it's not anti-Semitism to claim that Jews control the media, economy, government, and other social institutions. Now, it is impossible to ignore the fact, unless a willing blindness exists within the individual, that Jews play a prominent role, and I believe a role of undue influence, over politics in the United States especially, but also through the whole Western world. And that they also have undue influence in media and in central banking, Rothschild being the biggest name and example, and in other social institutions. Now, this student, he was right. It's not anti-Semitism to actually examine facts, but that's the way labels are. I mean, if you say Islam is bad because it's raping women, that's not Islamophobia, that's facts. Right? Because if you see that the majority of the rape culture gangs that have formed, and all of them that have been documented in Britain, right throughout Europe, if that's facts, that doesn't mean you're Islamophobic, but that's why these hashtag names are put there. And so this young man said it is not anti-Semitism to claim that Jews control it, media, economy, government, and other social institutions. Now, Gabriel Knight made the remark at a student Senate meeting Tuesday addressing a proposed resolution on anti-Semitism, according to the Stanford Daily. Knight said, questioning these potential power dynamics, I think, is not anti-Semitism. I think it's a very valid discussion. Now, later on, he got pressure put on him. And he apologised later in the meeting after Jewish community leaders and a Jewish student accused him of anti-Semitism. So you can see what happens. So basically, Jewish interests don't want anyone else speaking about the undue influence that they have over the economy, over politics, over culture, unless they themselves are the ones talking about it. And this often happens. Now, a good example of this is found in an article called Jews Own Hollywood, Actor Blackballed Since 2004 for Playing Jesus. If you're still not convinced that Jews rule Hollywood with an iron fist, look no further than the career of devout Roman Catholic actor James Patrick Jim Caviezel. Caviezel was a rising star until his portrayal of Jesus in Mel Gibson's blockbuster, The Passion of the Christ, which brought in over $400 million on a $30 million budget, was labelled, wait for it, anti-Semitic. A code word for the truth hitting too close to home for the Jewish media masters. Since playing the Son of God in the 2004 film, he said offers had dried up, and he is shunned by many within the industry, only appearing in a handful of films. So the next time you're reminded that Jewish control of Hollywood is an anti-Semitic canard, remember Caviezel and all other personalities who made the mistake of getting too close to the truth for those in control of Tinseltown and beyond. So what happened? Well, this guy played the role of Jesus. He was an aspiring up-and-coming actor. And since he portrayed Jesus, basically he's been ostracized from the Hollywood power brokers. And from another article which basically states the same thing, Jews who control Hollywood tell stars better not mention Palestine. It's official right now, the number one rule in Hollywood is that you can talk about anything political except Israel's attack on Christians and Muslims in Gaza, Palestine. That's not a conspiracy theory from critics of Israel or Jew-hating neo-Nazis. Instead, that was the thesis of a candid article in the August 1 edition of The Hollywood Reporter, the influential trade journal of the entertainment industry. The article was bluntly titled, Rule Number One, Talk About Anything Political in Hollywood Except Gaza. Noting that such an article would appear in a magazine considered must reading for those in show business was not so subtle warning that anyone who violates that rule is in a tough road ahead. Noting several celebrities that expressed sympathies for the plight of Gaza commented ominously that for now at least powerful Jewish moguls in Hollywood were simply dismissing those entertainers as being uninformed. However, continued speaking out this way and there will be trouble. And then it goes through a heap of different examples of Hollywood actors that have basically touched too close to the nerve. Now, recently I talked to you about how the Jews were the enemies of Christianity, and that the fact that Judaism, and Talmudic Judaism especially, is not only antagonistic to Christianity, but is, as the Bible points out, an anti-Christ religious system. Now, I did say that in my commentary that the Jews have stated that they would kill Yeshua again if they had the chance. Here it is, Sarah Silverman, on killing what we Christians believe who the Messiah is, Yeshua, again.
I wear this St. Christopher medal sometimes because I'm Jewish, but my boyfriend is Catholic, and it was cute the way he gave it to me. You know, he said, if it doesn't burn through my skin, it will protect me. Who cares? Different religions. You know, I mean, I guess if the only time it's an issue, I suppose, would be like if you're having a baby, you got to figure out like how you want to raise your baby or whatever, you know, which wouldn't even still not be an issue for us because we'd be honest, you know, and just say, you know, like, mommy is one of the chosen people and daddy believes that Jesus is magic. That's not nice.
I want you to note the way that the Jews openly mock Christianity, and indeed Yeshua himself. Here it comes.
Now Jesus is magic. He, you know, because he turned water to wine, and I think he made the Statue of Liberty disappear in the 80s or something. You know, the Jews got all, you know, they didn't want, when that Jesus movie came out, you know, no, the Jews didn't want people to see it because, you know, they felt, you know, everybody blames the Jews for killing Christ. And then the Jews try to pass it off on the Romans. You know, I'm one of the few people that believes it was the blacks. I don't care. Good. I hope the Jews did kill Christ. I'd do it again. In a second. Right here is Birkenstocks clacking this way.
Now there it is. She openly admits that she would do it again in a second. As I've said before in the past, friends, this kingdom of Babylon has multitudes of different layers. It takes a thinking mind to be able to deconstruct the way it all works. But the different anti-Christ religious systems are all working together against a common enemy. And the anti-Christ system of Judaism, the anti-Christ system of Islam, and the pagan anti-Christ system of the second Babylon being Rome, the head of the great whore of the kingdom of Babylon. These are all working together to destroy the common enemy. And the old saying that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And these are working together as coalitions, and they're working through all of the cultural Marxist memes to create civil unrest, destabilize society, take away what is unique about your Christian white European heritage, and to blend that into this mongrel diversity agenda. And the Bible says that they shall mingle themselves with seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another. So friends, there's a lot we need to look at. Many different things taking place around the world. Earthquakes, warfare on the streets, cultural revolutions. All of these things are a sign of the times. And well, thank you again for joining us today. I'll be taking a couple of weeks off. I need a couple of weeks out of the media matrix to enjoy the sunlight and the beautiful nature around me. I want to thank you for joining us once again on Fair Dinkum Radio. Until next time, You keep well and goodbye.